Thank you for tuning in to the FactCheckVaccine.com audio stream podcast. If you find the following information helpful, please share it with others. And now we begin the audio stream.
Welcome, everyone, to another extraordinary interview here on Brighteon Conversations. Remember, we are the platform where we can exercise free speech that is not allowed on the major big tech platforms. And today we have a first-time guest, but you've seen him in other interviews, or perhaps you haven't, since some of those interviews have been banned. But his name is Dr. Peter McCullough, and he is just an extraordinary individual. He's a professor of medicine, Texas A&M, Dallas. He's published, I think, 42 peer-reviewed papers on COVID. He's been at the forefront of trying to help save lives in this, and he has a very powerful and very timely message for what's happening with medicine and science and COVID. So, Dr. McCullough, it's an honor to have you on. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mike. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on. You've been one of the most requested guests for our audience. They've been just really enthralled by what you have said in other interviews. Can you give us kind of a summary of where you think we are right now with COVID and the failed response by government authorities around the world? Why are they not doing the right thing?
Well, the quick summary is that independent doctors innovated and learned how to treat the virus. So your audience can really settle down and understand that if someone's over age 50 with multiple medical problems, they can be treated with a standard multi-drug protocol plus nutraceuticals, get through the illness just fine, and avoid hospitalization and death. So we've taken the fear out of COVID-19. We treat it at home. Individuals under age 50, no medical problems, they can breeze through the illness, no treatment needed, unless severe symptoms develop. And again, just a nutraceutical bundle, which is, you know, probably modestly helpful. The drugs have really helped. I mean, we use EUA, monoclonal antibodies, the Regeneron product. All doctors can make a call to their local emergency room. Patients get an antibody infusion, just like President Trump got. You saw how he breezed through COVID. That can be done. So if I got a senior called me today, I'd have him go to the Baylor ER, get an antibody infusion. They'll breeze right through it. We use drugs in sequence, oral drugs to reduce viral replication. We use inhaled and oral steroids.
Can you list some of those medications, please, because people want to write these down?
Right. So the first thing we do is we use nutraceuticals. That would be zinc 50 milligrams, vitamin D 5,000 international units, vitamin C 3,000 milligrams, quercetin 500 milligrams twice a day. That's a good nutraceutical bundle right there. Probably modestly helpful, and actually some supportive data. For the antibodies, we have a Regeneron product that's given IV, and it's given over an hour with an hour observation done in the ER. You can go in by schedule in the first couple of days of illness, but to get it done. If someone is admitted, on the other side of the admission, we can actually give a GlaxoSmithKline monoclonal antibodies. These are very helpful drugs, and patients should demand them. So they should ask for these drugs. It shouldn't be a mystery to get them. Just ask for the Regeneron antibody infusion, as President Trump got.
What's your take on hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin?
Yeah, so after the antibody infusion, then we can use oral drugs. And we have hydroxychloroquine, over 200 supportive studies, 200 milligrams twice a day, ivermectin, about 60 supportive studies there. And we can use about 18 milligrams a dose every other day for three doses. And then outside the United States, favipiravir, we combine that with azithromycin or doxycycline to reduce bacterial superinfection and to reduce overlap between what's called atypical organisms. And then we use inhaled budesonide, 800 milligrams twice a day, micrograms twice a day. If on day five, respiratory symptoms, we use oral prednisone for about a quick 5 days, no taper. We use a drug called colchicine once a day for 30 days, reduces inflammation. And then really on the back end, we use aspirin 325 milligrams a day as a blood thinner. Then high-risk patients, we use Lovenox. So the doctor will decide with the patient which kind of program it's going to be, but it's typically things to reduce viral replication, things to reduce inflammation, and then thrombosis. None of the drugs are individually essential. There are protocols where no hydroxychloroquine and no ivermectin is used, and the Just the anti-inflammatories and blood thinners are used. That's the South African study approach. Others kind of feature hydroxy or ivermectin. That's fine too. But what the listeners need to know is that there are adequate signals of benefit and acceptable safety to use drugs in combination. The only people who get admitted to the hospital and die are the ones who get no outpatient treatment. So we have to demand treatment. We have the American Physicians and Surgeons, AAPS online. It's got a free guide. Download it. Everybody should have it. It's been downloaded millions of times. We have a list of treating doctors. There's another wonderful site called the Frontline Critical Care Consortium, FLCC. They also have a great network of doctors. We have four national telemedicine services. The featured one is called MyFreeDoctor.com. And that's a free service. You don't need your insurance or anything. You just give a donation if you want to. Doctors work 24/7. They will take your intake. They'll get the medicines called into your pharmacy. If your pharmacy won't fill them, we'll use a mail order pharmacy. We'll get the drugs to you, get going, and nobody has to suffer through this illness. There are 15 regional telemedicine services, 500 treating doctors. It's called Sequence Multidrug Therapy. It's published in the peer-reviewed literature, been used millions of times. Let me say this much. This really kicked in at the early part of January. We crushed our curve. That's what crushed our curve. That was before anybody was vaccinated. We crushed our curve. Since that time, we've been flat, kind of flat out, leveling out through the pandemic. Mexico City crushed their curve with early treatment. Down in South America, countries did. India just crushed their curve with early treatment. Early treatment treats the problem. Masks and vaccines don't actually treat the illness. We need to treat the illness with multiple drugs.
Well, how shocked are you in observing the official response to this? How shocked are you as a trained, published physician who has the right motivation to help save lives, to help people get well, to reduce human suffering? This is supposed to be the moral code of being a physician. How shocked are you of the suppression of all the things that you just mentioned, from big tech censoring the mention and the CDC censoring and the WHO censoring? Why didn't we have a national response that said, hey, let's use what works?
Well, we should have. We should have had doctors in charge who actually are real doctors, who are board certified, who are taking care of patients with COVID-19. We needed doctors who had courage, who actually behaved like trauma surgeons. We don't need doctors on TV who are not working in teams, who are not board certified, who have never seen a COVID patient. That's what America and the world has been looking at here. And it's really an atrocity. Doctors always work in teams. We should never have a single doctor say anything on TV. Get a team. Get a team. We work in teams in rounds. We've seen no international collaboration. You know, I gave grand rounds today by WebEx to France. And we were collaborating. We were exchanging ideas. Americans have not seen any exchange of ideas between doctors on TV. They've basically seen a medical dictatorship from one person, and Americans should be very alarmed on where's the teams of doctors, where's the international collaboration. Here I'm sitting here in Texas, and a few hours south of us, they're handing out treatment kits by the millions in baggies, and Texans would never know about it because there's not any window to the outside world.
Now, you've published many, many papers. You're one of the most prolific writers in the area of internal medicine, and your work is cited by thousands of other studies and papers. So your history here of research and medicine is unassailable. And what you just said about a medical dictatorship seems so true. When last year, remember when states, and I believe Michigan was one of them, actually outlawed the prescribing of hydroxychloroquine for COVID. Why would a state government criminalize? Oh, and by the way, that happened after The Lancet published that later retracted bogus study that said hydroxychloroquine caused heart tissue scarring and so on. But this seems like a medical dictatorship, as you said, prohibiting the practice of good medicine by doctors who are on the front lines. Would that be an accurate assessment?
It's accurate. Someone just sent me a treatment protocol for one of the Baylor Scott & White hospitals in our health system in Central Texas, kind of right applies to you. And that protocol to this day says, do not use hydroxychloroquine to treat COVID-19. We have 200 supported studies. Lancet published a fraudulent paper. The FDA, based on the fraudulent paper, said, do not use hydroxychloroquine. Here we are a year later, and hospital treatment guidelines say don't use hydroxychloroquine. No one reviewed the literature. No one updated the literature. We have 200 studies. There's a 30,000 patient study from Iran showing a giant reduction in hospitalization and death with hydroxychloroquine-based program. So what you're seeing here is bad research. It's bad medicine. People aren't updating. There should be weekly updates, monthly guidelines updates. Here we're frozen in time, fraudulent paper, ill-advised guidance from the FDA, and frozen in time with no contemporaneous review. None. It's malfeasance.
Well, that's the thing. It seems, at least in my assessment, they deliberately pushed a fraudulent study through the Lancet, and I believe also in the New England Journal of Medicine, knowing that the retractions might never really happen. Like they've established now that hydroxychloroquine is dangerous, and it's hard to ever get that taken back out of the medical literature or even in the minds of the people who rely on that literature. So it's kind of like, you know, the New York Times publishing something that's false, and then the retraction comes on page 8 in small print, you know, a day later. Nobody sees the retraction.
I agree with this. I agree with you. I think it was intentional. I think the entire action was intentional, and it was aligned to do harm. It was aligned to hurt people. And hydroxychloroquine became the focal point of how individuals with intent to do harm could do harm. You know, hydroxychloroquine, the second largest hydroxychloroquine plant outside of Taipei was mysteriously burned to the ground. Yes. We have reports of hydroxychloroquine being burned at night in the pharmacies across Africa. In Queensland, Australia, in August, or in April of last year, Queensland, Australia, they put on the books that they would put a doctor in jail if a doctor tried to help a patient with hydroxychloroquine. But come on, I prescribe this every day, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus. We can give it to pregnant women. I mean, we prescribe hydroxychloroquine. You can give it to patients with dry eyes and other rheumatologic conditions. And suddenly in COVID-19, we can't use a simple, safe drug to help people. Something Americans should think. Something is really wrong. We should have been, you know, we had the right idea. We stockpiled hydroxychloroquine. We had it ready to go, but then we didn't release it from the stockpile. We made it impossible to use.
Well, you just hinted at something, and I want to explore this a little more deeply with you, that you got to intent. You believe that the intent was to cause harm. And I think most of our viewers would absolutely agree with you, and I do too, although I'm here asking your view, not really my views here today. But if their intent was to cause harm and not just complacency or bureaucracy or inadvertent mistakes, what does this mean about the institution of medicine and science in the context of this pandemic? I mean, why aren't they trying to save as many lives as possible? What's going on here?
It's in the minds of doctors. In fact, there was a doctor who has done some of the really just, I think, probably low quality research, some very poor randomized trials that were stopped early. And they always stop early. And hydroxychloroquine is always a little bit ahead and it's winning. They stop early and say, oh, there's no difference. Hydroxychloroquine didn't do anything. Well, this doctor who has been leading some of these studies, he put out a message on Twitter and said, oh, most good doctors have moved on from hydroxychloroquine. It's like, you know, why state that when hydroxychloroquine is a worldwide standard? It's a standard. It's always been a standard in Europe, in Rome. Italy has a whole program called Treatment Domiciliary at Home. Eric Grimaldi, who leads that effort, they've had major rallies in piazzas all over Italy declaring zero hospitalizations with an early approach to hydroxychloroquine. Thousands and thousands of people. It's standard in Iran, standard in Russia, used widely in India. And you know what? When the first wave of COVID-19 hit in March of last year, that was the Wuhan version. That was the wild type. That was the most serious version. You know, COVID's gotten easier and easier to treat, but the most serious wave, we had a very little blip in the United States. You know why? Because we had a massive use of hydroxychloroquine. It was then when agencies tried to kill it, that's when the epidemic got out of control. We should have stuck with hydroxy hard all the way through. And you know, ivermectin works fine. We don't use them alone, but when we seek some in with aspirin and steroids, blood thinners and colchicine, the program works tremendously. 85% reductions in hospitalizations and death.
Well, how much do you think a profit motive is behind this? I mean, do you get the feeling that if hydroxychloroquine were a new on-patent drug that just came out, you know, Johnson & Johnson, let's say, and it were $1,000 a dose, and all governments offered to buy it at $1,000 a dose, do you get the feeling that suddenly it would be a miracle cure in the media if that were the case?
No, I don't. Believe it or not, I don't think it's a profit motive. You know, Merck and Sanofi have had oral drugs in development. They're part of Operation Warp Speed. They've been on slow gear with these oral drugs, slow gear. Mm. You think if these companies wanted to make some money on oral drugs, and these drug companies, they know how to do big trials. They know how to move fast. Why are they moving at a snail's pace? You know, we are overloaded with millions of cases of COVID-19. You know what we needed? We needed 20,000 person outpatient trials of multiple drugs, and we needed it last year. Nobody did that, and believe me, they all had the resources. So I don't think it's profit driven.
Hmm. What do you think is the motive of the suppression of the treatments?
I think it was all to prepare the population for mass vaccination. I think it was very intentional to maximize the amount of fear, suffering, hospitalization, and death to prepare the population to accept mass vaccination. And when mass vaccination came out, they didn't say targeted or just for the seniors or just where the maximum benefit is. They said a needle in every arm, and they meant it. And nowadays, that's all you hear about morning, noon, and night is vaccination. You don't see a word about treatment in the hospital, any updates on treatment. It's vaccination morning, noon, and night. And people are dreaming of mass vaccination. We have doctors screaming at patients, telling them they have to be vaccinated. Doctors saying that only vaccinated patients can be in their waiting room. I mean, everything has been set up on this vaccine. There's been Saturday Night Live skits about the vaccine. Since when do we do that? Vaccines are never that exciting.
No, I want to ask you more details about the vaccine. Just want to remind our viewers here that you have a broadcast. It's on AmericaOutloud.com. AmericaOutloud.com. It's the McCullough Report. Is that once a week, or what's the schedule on that?
Yeah, it comes out. It's done. It's run twice on weekends, and then it comes out on the iHeartRadio and the big podcast platforms. What I do is I bring in experts who are absolute, and we go through their background. So America knows these are the top people all over the world. And we do interviews. You know, I try to go 8 to 10 minutes and really get the key information out. And I've interviewed absolutely the top people in order to break through to America, because we have what's called the Trusted News Service. I hope everybody understands this. We have an overt censoring program that all the major media signed on to at the beginning of December. And the agreement was that they were going to mass promote the vaccine, and they were going to suppress all information on treatment and on vaccine safety. And everybody signed off on it. Everybody did. So MSNBC, NBC, CNN, Twitter, YouTube, they have explicitly said we are going to squash any valid scientific information on treatment and on safety and just mass promote the vaccine. And that's what we got.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's just been propaganda. And a couple of things that I've noticed in the media about vaccines is, number one, any vaccine injuries are always designated rare, no matter how many people they impact, such as the myocarditis affecting young, healthy men right now.
Can I address that? Because I agree with you.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Vaccine has been said to be rare. Any claim that something is rare means that you have to go through every person vaccinated and see if they got it. You just can't take a small number of cases that got pushed forward and divide it by everybody who got it and a priori say the people who on the denominator didn't get it. That's not true. So last night I was on Fox News, and the announcer said, well, what about, you know, these are rare cases. I said, listen, there's 387,000 safety reports with the vaccines. That's more than any medical product in history by a mile. And he goes, well, these are rare. I said, well, I don't think so. That's not rare. So the answer is, with these vaccines, none of these things are rare. In fact, they are far too common, and it's worrisome.
Well, and it shows the intellectual dishonesty because they can use that word rare in whatever way they want. You can bet that if a dietary supplement were causing this number of reports, it would be called a danger to the public and common. It wouldn't be rare.
Well, let me give you some standards. 1976 swine flu pandemic, 25 deaths, 500 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. It's 22 million people vaccinated. It's off the market. Okay, a drug, typically a drug, 5 unexplained deaths, gets a black box warning for death, 50 unexplained deaths, off the market. Okay, with all the vaccines combined, 500 million shots a year, 70 vaccines, we get about 150 or 60 deaths that roll in, not related in time to the vaccine over the course of a year. COVID-19, we're at 6,100 deaths, 44% occur in the 48 hours after the shot. And we started to see the mortality diverge from expected on January 22nd. And there's been no safety report from the FDA or NIH or nothing on the media. No press briefing on vaccine safety, none. Americans should be alarmed that we have not had a press briefing on safety. We should be very alarmed.
Yes.
The vaccine, it may not work, but it should be safe. And if we don't have any update or press briefing on safety, no publication of safety, I think Americans should be greatly alarmed.
Well, but the other thing that the media does is they say, even when they acknowledge some adverse reactions, they say the benefits are worth the risks. But as you know, as a scientist yourself, when you're talking about an age group that only has maybe a 1 in a million chance of mortality from the vaccine, from COVID, what possible benefit can there be that outweighs any substantial risk, right? There's no benefit to taking it in those age groups.
No, and there's some countries that really, for instance, Germany is pretty similar to the United States. I want to say maybe they have 30% of people vaccinated. They're just kind of focusing on people over 65. I think Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida had the right thing. Remember, he didn't fool around. He got the people over 65 vaccinated. Then, you know, the rest of it. It's very hard at this point in time with the amount of safety and the amount of neurologic damage, heart damage, blood clots and deaths with these vaccines, it's very hard to find any group that would benefit right now. I was encouraging the vaccine in my patients. About 70% of them got it in December, January, February. And right now, based on the safety, I can't in good conscience, I can't recommend it to anybody. Maybe on a case-by-case basis, there's going to be a far safer vaccine coming called Novavax. We're very excited about Novavax. And Novavax is not based on at all and should be much, much better in terms of safety. And we're hoping that they can speed this one in and phase out the first generation vaccines.
So another thing that I've noticed the media doing on this is they conflate emergency authorization use with, quote, approval of the vaccine. So you'll see newscasters tell their audiences things like, well, the FDA has approved all these vaccines, but they haven't really. It hasn't gone through the long-term clinical trials, hasn't been declared safe or efficacious, either one. What do you think? This is just part of the deliberate deception or what?
Yeah, I think it is deliberately deceptive. Americans who have gotten a vaccine, and 45% of Americans have gotten the vaccine, so that's about half of your audience, Mike. They've signed the consent. They know exactly what the vaccine consent says. It says this is not approved. It says we don't know if this is going to work. It says it's investigational, means it's research, means you're signing up for research, and they collect your personal information to track you. And it says, we don't know what the side effects are. They can range all the way from a sore arm to death. And that's what the consent form. 45% of Americans signed up for this. The vaccines that they signed up for are considered genetic gene delivery medicines. Okay, they are genetic, biologically active products. Okay, the typical vaccine is either a protein or a dead virus or an inactivated virus. It's never a gene transfer substance. Whoever signed up for this, you're in 45% of your listeners signed up for this, they took Pfizer, Moderna, or J&J. They took a genetic product, okay? That product transfers genetic material into your cells. That's what it did. And then inside the cells and the cells all over the body, they produce a dangerous protein called the spike protein. And wherever the genetic material goes, and we know it goes to the brain, it goes to the heart, it produces the spike protein, which is inside cells, damages those cells, it damages the surface of the cells, causes inflammation, and then from there it travels in the body for about 2 weeks, causing damage to blood vessels and causing blood clots. So Senator Johnson last night had a town hall for vaccine injury victims, and there were dozens of them, and they told America about how they've sustained brain damage or heart damage from the vaccine. And this has occurred in thousands and thousands of people. 21,000 people have been hospitalized after the vaccine. 27% of them are below age 50. It's astonishing how dangerous the vaccines are.
Yeah, and you just mentioned several bombshells there that I want to get into. You referred to the biodistribution study, one of which I'm aware is out of Japan. And the mainstream vaccine industry claims that these spike protein nanoparticles do not circulate throughout the body, but the studies show they do. I think there's another pharmacokinetic study as well that establishes that. What you just mentioned is huge. I mean, just based on that research alone, it seems like the FDA should pull the emergency authorization and say, wait a second, we need to study this in more depth. We can't inject people if this is circulating throughout the entire body. But they're not doing that. What's going on?
The vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and Moderna have a very dangerous mechanism of action. We cannot have genetic substances circulating in our body in lipid nanoparticles or other forms of matrix nanoparticles and go to our brain. We can't do that. I mean, that cannot be allowed. It's a dangerous mechanism of action. The Japanese did not trust Pfizer. And when Pfizer said it stayed locally in the arm, Japanese said, we don't trust you. Show us where this goes. And it was a biodistribution study done of the nanoparticles, not the messenger RNA, but the nanoparticles. And they went everywhere. They did wash out of organs in a couple of days, but they hyper-concentrated in the ovaries. In Europe, they didn't trust Moderna on fertility. And they asked them, what happens to fertility with Moderna? They did an animal study, and Moderna dropped fertility. So the FDA, Mike, told Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J, no pregnant women, no women of childbearing potential who cannot assure contraception. They did that for a reason. They knew the vaccines should not be used in young women. They knew that.
And yet the vaccine is being promoted for pregnant women all across America today by the medical establishment. But just getting back to that study, as I recall, one of the other areas where the nanoparticles tended to cluster was in the adrenals. So now we're talking about hormonal interference, which could affect fertility. It could affect mental states, moods. It could affect so many things, right, in the body. Unknown effects.
Right. Well, there have been nanoparticle studies. There was one from China published about 8 years or so ago that tested these nanoparticles. And they asked, where did they go? And they made a brilliant, nice rainbow of all the organs where the nanoparticles shower. And they did show that they go to the ovaries. So the point is, and the adrenals. So the point is, the FDA, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, they knew, or they should have known, that these particles are going to hit these vital organs. And then when they drop their genetic payload, then they're going to start producing the spike protein and damaging cells in those organs. So it was not surprising when young women were ill-advised and took the vaccine, they started having problems with their periods. That was not unexpected. In a New England Journal of Medicine paper of pregnancy of women who took the vaccine, the authors concluded it was safe to give the vaccine in pregnancy. Now, no woman carried the baby 9 months because the vaccines haven't been a lot around 9 months, but they looked at different windows of time and they divided all the pregnancy loss rates by the largest denominator possible. So it was really false reporting. When we zeroed in on the first trimester and just divided by those who got the vaccine in the trimester, not those who got it later on, there was an 83% loss in fetal in the babies. So these vaccines are directly killing babies in the first trimester, and it is absolutely atrocious, horrible. Obstetrics and gynecology right now is recommending that women, pregnant women, take the COVID-19 vaccine. Pregnant women can breeze right through COVID-19. There has been some bad outcomes, but it is very treatable with our drugs. We can even use hydroxychloroquine through pregnancy. We can use prednisone and other drugs. No woman should ever take the risk with the COVID-19 vaccine during pregnancy, period. The FDA, Pfizer, Moderna, didn't allow it in their clinical trials. It should not be allowed in practice today.
Yeah, that's you're talking common sense medicine here, but it seems like common sense has been thrown out the window. But I'm so glad you brought this up, because it seems like beginning in about maybe 6 months and continuing on, we may see a collapse in birth rates and maybe ongoing infertility problems. But that brings up the obvious question. Do you think that there is an infertility or long-term population reduction agenda? Many people believe that. Lots of my guests have discussed that. Is that something that you subscribe to, or we don't have enough data yet to conclude that?
You know, I've been so focusing on the medical response and taking care of my patients. I know others are working on, you know, people have called them conspiracy theories. The rapper, RC Rapper, says, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory if it keeps coming true. And I'm not going to comment on conspiracy theories, but if you ask me, do you think these vaccines are going to have an impact on fertility? I think the answer is yes. We've already seen that in the Moderna application. And now with the fetal loss data fairly calculated from the New England Journal of Medicine study, there's no doubt about it. Pregnant women are going to lose their babies if they take the vaccine. And it's worse than that. Once they've conceived and they're breastfeeding, we now have vignettes in the vaccine adverse event reporting system where women take the vaccine, they generate the spike protein, and we infer the spike protein goes through the milk and then kills the baby. So these vaccines need to stay away from babies and mothers and women who are trying to conceive. I mean, there can't be a more clear message. You know, women are concerned about, you know, drinking half a glass of wine during pregnancy. How in the world could they take a shot of a wildly experimental, unproven, unsafe vaccine for the first time? How could they ever do it? It's almost as if Americans and doctors and everybody are just brainwashed together. They are brainwashed. They've been propagandized, and they are blindly accepting something that they should just stay away from.
Well, I think most of our audience would agree with that. And by the way, you mentioned earlier about the percentage of people getting the vaccine. I think I'm proud to say close to 0% of our audience has taken this vaccine. It's very close to 0% because they're well educated and well informed. But I want to ask you about possible pushback, because, you know, many doctors have been threatened, censored, fired for speaking out. They've been silenced even early on. I remember in New York City back in late March of last year, one particular doctor was saying, whoa, we need to be treating this as an oxygen deprivation condition affecting hemoglobin. And he was silenced. And this has happened ever since then. What kind of pushback are you getting? Are they trying to silence you from doing interviews like this?
No, I have to tell you, I have, I have over 600 peer-reviewed publications. I'm the editor of two major journals, senior associate editor of a third. I'm the most published person in my field in the world. I've had COVID-19 myself. I've suffered through it. My wife's side of the family, we've had fatalities in her side of the family. I can tell you right now, I am supremely qualified to give my opinions. I have the right to give my opinions. And anybody who thinks they can threaten me or take me on, bring it on. No one's had the guts to do it, and they would absolutely positively be pummeled and be ashamed. In fact, I've had a couple people, and in the end, I think they feel shame. They feel shame for their lack of courage and their lack of ability to compassionately help patients. Patients cried out for help. 600,000 of them cried out for help. Doctors, healthcare systems, and clinics turned them down. They suffered, then they were hospitalized. They went into isolation, Mike. They never saw their families again, and then they died. We have a long, long line of shame, and there's a lot of people walking that line of shame. Most of them can't look me in the eye. I'll tell you right now, they cannot look me in the eye. They are so ashamed of themselves.
Do you think that there will be, at some point, looking back, some kind of awakening? In previous interviews, you've described some doctors as being almost like they're in a trance or under a spell of some kind. Do you think that they will be able to awaken from that trance and look at what happened and recognize that that was not a high-integrity practicing of medicine?
Some people have said that the awakening out of the trance will be like Nazi war crime doctors, where they'll somehow come out of their trance and they're going to be terrified at what they did. And I would bring obstetricians to the very front. And when they come out of their trance and they realize in horror that they were advising pregnant women to get injections of genetic, biological, these are gene transfer platforms, wildly experimental, that produce in an uncontrolled manner a dangerous protein for the human body that damages blood vessels, causes blood clots. We know this. We've known that this is a blood clotting illness for a long time, that they advise us. I think these obstetricians are going to wake up in a cold sweat, and they're going to be horrified with what they recommended. They are going to be, and it's going to be, I got to tell you, we have years of reckoning on this. We have years of reckoning. There is a line of shame that these doctors and nurses and mid-level providers and clinics and hospitals will walk. That is atrocious. In pregnancy, above all conditions, it's primum non nocere. We would never do harm to a pregnant woman. We would, you know, we have drugs. We have pregnancy classes A, B, and C. We would never, ever give a drug that we even thought had a chance of causing harm to a pregnant woman, let alone just jack them up with a genetic juice, which we now know is absolutely positively dangerous. It is atrocious what's going on right now, and we can't be more alarmed. I think any woman listening to this who has any ounce of common sense ought to absolutely talk to every other woman, and you know what? Have some real conversations with your obstetricians. Give them a phone call, send an email, and say, listen, wake up. What are you doing right here, right now? That's causing harm.
Now, along with doctors at one point waking up, as you were just describing, do you think there's also a very real risk that when all of this eventually comes out and looking back on it, that the public's faith in the entire institution of medicine and science may be so fractured that at that point, the public may refuse to even consider helpful interventions and therapies that could save lives because all of it may be discredited at some point, depending on how big this thing goes?
Right. So things are really going off the rails. So public not only doesn't trust the media, doesn't trust the public agencies, doesn't trust their doctors or doctor groups, and they don't trust each other. They don't trust each other. Do you know right now that there are grandparents that say that they won't see their grandchildren unless they're vaccinated?
Yes.
So now they're putting, and the grandparents are vaccinated. So now they're putting the risk of blood clots and myocarditis and death onto their grandchildren and saying they won't see each other for Disney. Do you know we have 9% of colleges that are mandating the investigational vaccine? So they're actually mandating their student bodies participate in research which is openly dangerous biological products that have no ability to help these youngsters. And you know, in many of these colleges, there's no policy, there's no exemption process. And do you know that in many of these colleges, the faculties aren't taking it? Now, the FDA, CDC, and NIH, they're not taking the vaccine. They're not taking it. And the faculty is not taking it. So they're going to make the students take it under duress. So the vaccine has been propagandized and now socially weaponized so the universities can hurt the student population, just like the obstetricians are hurting their patients, like the grandparents are hurting their grandchildren. Mike, something is really disturbing wrong, and there are so many players in this.
Well said, and we're up against the time here. We could continue to talk. Hopefully you'll come back and join us again, but I just want to say the people watching this, thank you for your integrity. And thank you for your courage, but also for sticking to your principles. You want evidence. You want to show efficacy. You want to reduce risk and save lives. And that's what every doctor should be in America. And somehow that seems like it's lost. And that's what freaks people out as much as COVID. It's that who can we trust anymore?
Well, I got to tell you, if there's ever a time for courage, for integrity, for commitment to principles of medical ethics and commitment to biomedical science. And lastly, a commitment to justice. Now is the time. And listen, if that's my role and that's your role, that's our role that we're serving right now. And America needs to get behind its heroes because we've got a long uphill battle. There is a disturbing trance that is basically, it's like a black cloud over the world right now. And we're trying to find our way out. There's so much harm and suffering going on, and none of it is needed.
And I'll say, and you are one of the bright points of light in this darkness. And the AAPS, this is a shining moment for that organization. They are so right. I don't even know what to say, but we're going to interview, I think, other prominent people from the AAPS because their voices are desperately needed right now to save lives and end human suffering and also help stop this pandemic. So thank you, Dr. McCullough. It's an honor to have you on. I've really enjoyed this conversation. You're a wonderful person. I really honor your knowledge and your courage. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Great interview.